This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. Streaming live at freakradio.org. Please never forget to tell all your friends, click on the red oval that they'll see on top of the little cartoon picture of the radio tower main page of our website, freakradio.org. Good morning. My name is Ren Tawil. This is the weekend edition of the Mideast Madness Show. Almost couldn't pronounce that. Mideast Madness Show. And it is 11:06 a.m. this Saturday, November 23rd. 50th anniversary plus one day. In the year of our Lord, 2013. So, if that time and date matches with your time-space continuum, you will know that the show is live. And therefore, if you call into the studio, you will have a real live person answering and talking to you, assuming all the phones work properly, which they generally do here. Also, in the course of the rest of this day, this Saturday, November 23rd, and in the course of the next 7 days, there will be refeeds or repeats of this Mideast Madness Show, which does come to you live every Saturday at 11, starting at 11 a.m. for a couple of hours. There is also the original time slot for Mideast Madness every Monday at 3 in the afternoon, 3 to 4:55. So you've got two time slots to pick. If you are curious about the content or anything else regarding past shows, you will find recordings of most of the past shows of Mideast Madness if you go to another wonderful web service called radioforall.net. That's the word radio, the numerical character 4, ALL.NET, radioforall.net. You will find an archives for the Mideast Madness shows, available with free podcasts for your listening pleasure, to listen whenever you want to. If you do not or cannot restrain, cannot or do not want to restrain yourselves to the Saturday or Monday schedule time for the live shows. Also, Indie Bay Santa Cruz. Santa Cruz, Indy Bay, Indybay, has reruns available for these shows. You have to go to the calendar and click back, back and back and back, week by week, month by month. But I've been informed that they're there, that the shows are retained in perpetuity. Okay, a little more coffee here so I can make sure my throat is healthy and for you to listen to. Oh, that does help. It's cold in Santa Cruz these days, folks. We actually had a real rainfall that lasted all day. Started as a misty drizzle, until about noon, and then it really came down a couple of days ago. We've been living the life of the desert nomad for a couple of years, at least up higher up in the hills where I live. Alas, the goddess is having mercy upon us and seeing to it that we do occasionally get the rain here. But it is cold, my friends. Where did I put that? You know, I've mentioned several times Jewish Voice for Peace, which has members around the world, Jewish Voice for Peace, or JVP, cites the following figures. JVP has more than 140,000 supporters in the United States and around the globe. They divide the U.S. into four parts. In the West, and this probably has a lot to do with the fact that JVP was founded and is headquartered in Berkeley, California, which is the East Bay of the San Francisco Bay Area. 36% of the membership of JVP is in the West. Another 32% is out east, confined pretty much to the northeastern corridor from Maine to Maryland. In my former adopted homeland of the Midwest, 19% of JVP's membership lies, and the remaining 15% is in the South, and supporters in 152 countries. I want to read some of these snippets of comments from members of JVP, and I do admit to being an annually paid member of JVP, even though I'm not Jewish. Obviously, the great majority of members are Jewish, practicing or not. And the thing about Jewish Voice for Peace as compared to, say, the Anti-Defamation League or the American Jewish Committee, etc., etc., is that JVP is enlightened. They genuinely seek peace and justice, yes, folks, justice, for Palestinians as well as Israelis. They are, as a matter of policy, not professedly a Zionist organization, although they may contain Zionists. But if you're as familiar with JVP as I am, you'll know that probably most of them are not Zionists. They see Zionism as an affront to the true traditional values of Judaism. They see Zionism as full of hypocrisy in terms of establishing Jewish hegemony or Zionist hegemony in their adopted homeland. And so, staying on track here, I'm not going to read these snippets to you merely as a promotion for JVP or as an attempt to gain more paid memberships. All the more wonderful if you do go to JVP's website and decide to become a member. But I just, I really appreciate the kinds of things that are said here. Okay, again, these are quotations from members and supporters of JVP. Listen up. James Shamus, a professor in the School of the Arts, Columbia University, former CEO of Focus Features, producer of Brokeback Mountain, screenwriter for The Ice Storm. Mr. Shamus says, this is really a good one, I think of JVP as a normalization project. It's actually normal to practice real Jewish values and actually abnormal to blindly support things like occupation and oppression. End quote. So I guess when James Shamus says he thinks of JVP as a normalization project, I think what he's getting at is it levels the whole playing field, the playing field of facts on the ground in the Middle East, the whole playing field of the truth of what's really going on out there. Karen Ackerman, former political director of the AFL-CIO. Actually, these two people, both Shamus and Karen Ackerman, are new board members for JVP that they're welcoming. Ms. Ackerman says, Jewish Voice for Peace plays a unique and absolutely critical role in the progressive movements in our country today. JVP speaks to the imperative need for true equality, human rights, and economic rights for Palestinians as the only true path to peace. Committed to building a national grassroots movement through its chapters and its alliance with partners in organizing national campaigns, JVP is key to changing the dialogue in this country. Okay, now these are your plain old run-of-the-mill, but no less respectable, members and supporters of JVP. Steve Feldman, MD, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. After growing up deep in the Jewish community of Washington, D.C., I gradually came to the realization that my understanding of Palestinian people was terribly misguided. My understanding of Israel was profoundly affected by learning that Israel was created by the expulsions of whole villages of peaceful Palestinian families. I am an enthusiastic supporter of JVP, the one Jewish organization I see that walks the talk of Jewish values. Danny Kaplan, Chicago, Illinois. At last, I found an organization that matches my values, pursuing a rights-based approach to peace. I am inspired by JVP's strong leadership and the exciting new directions the organization is going in. Ed and Ethel Swede of San Diego. At the 2013 National Member Meeting, we were very impressed by JVP's leadership and membership and rock-solid commitment to equal rights for all people. We returned home and not only began to launch a San Diego chapter, but created a legacy fund which will provide future annual funding for JVP in perpetuity. Paul Kivell, Oakland, California. The Palestinian liberation struggle is necessary, powerful, and growing. JVP's work to end the occupation is creative, strategic, and effective. With one check, I get to support both. And again, this is not what I'm doing here is not for my main purpose to build the membership. All the better if you do decide to support JVP. I just want people to hear the comments of these members. Dara Wells Hajar, New York, New York. Jewish Voice for Peace inspires me because our organizing stems from a place of love and justice with a commitment to human rights. JVP has created a beautiful community of dedicated activists, teachers, mothers, fathers, grandparents, students, and artists from all over the world. We're working together in solidarity with Palestinians and Israelis towards ending the occupation of Palestine and bringing justice to the Middle East. Finally, a comment from Karen Platt, Albany, California, little community in the East Bay. I believe that it's crucial for American Jews opposed to the occupation and the human rights violations committed by the Israeli government to take a strong public stand. I'm inspired by JVP's contributions to this growing movement for justice for the Palestinian people and also towards minimizing the anti-Semitism that I believe results from Israel's unconscionable actions and policies. Let me read that last sentence again. I'm inspired by JVP's contributions to this growing movement for justice for the Palestinian people and also towards minimizing the anti-Semitism that I believe results from Israel's unconscionable actions and policies. Again, quotation from Ms. Karen Platt. So I'm not the only one who believes wholeheartedly that anti-Semitism is also generated to a considerable degree from the crimes that the Israeli government and Israeli military commits. Anti-Semitism is fueled by the very people who suffer from anti-Semitism. This is me talking, Ren talking now. Yeah, lots of other interesting things in this postal mailing that I got from JVP. Let me give you those phone numbers, or phone number. We do have two of them, but I just am lucky if I get any response on one. The main line into the studio to talk at me live and go on the air and all that stuff is area code 831-427-3772. Again, 831-427-3772. And once more, the area code is 831. I choked a little bit when I said 8 the first time. 831-427-3772. You may also flip me off a message. Don't take that expression too seriously. Send a message to the program directly to the email address of Mideast Madness. The address is MideastMadness@gmx.com. Again, G as in Gregorian, M as in Machiavellian, X as in xenophobe.com, gmx.com, MideastMadness@gmx.com. All right. More coffee here. Gotta keep that old throat open. My friends, the situation in Israel and Palestine is a very sad but all too understandable dichotomy. On the one hand, you have Israel, which economically is doing, at the very least, fairly well, if not much better. Israel being a place in this world which, since its inception in May of 1948, has up until recently and continuously been the most dangerous place on earth for a Jew to live. That might be pockmarked with a few exceptions of extreme anti-Semitism that are expressed explosively in, I don't know, the Soviet Union, other places around the world, possibly the Arab countries. But by and large, the most dangerous place for a Jew to expect to maintain their life and, to some degree, their livelihood has been in Israel. And the whole idea of the Zionist dream is to establish and maintain a secure homeland for the Jewish people. Very sadly, and I say this with a degree of a feeling of shame on my part, part of this has to do with the resistance and the hostility of Israel's neighboring Arab states. But I believe to a far less degree than most people realize. As I said a moment ago, up until recently, this has been the case with Israel, the danger to the Jewish people, to their lives. But you've got this absolute hegemony, which is a fancy word meaning political domination, civil domination, of Israel's so-called defense forces over the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip. In terms of direct occupation, that was the case from 67 until 2005. And then ongoingly since 2005, the suppression of the Gazan Palestinians has been maintained by locking down their borders, both land, air, and sea, for a brief momentous period in the latter half of 2008. There were about a half dozen vessels, or fewer even, which were not military. They were filled with caring human rights activists, and I had the pleasure of including myself among them. Some seagoing vessels that successfully sailed into and out of the port of Gaza City in solidarity with the Palestinian people. Nobody ever proved or even asserted that they have found any weaponry or anything that can be used in violent resistance against the Israeli occupation on those boats. I know for a fact that we didn't carry any weaponry, nothing malevolent, nothing that could hurt anyone, at least not intentionally. And then this awful massacre, motivated by political electioneering, happened 2 days after Christmas in 2008 and went into early 2009. The Israeli incursion and attack upon the Palestinian Arabs, killing roughly 1,400 of them, including a couple of hundred children. And shortly afterwards, Benjamin Netanyahu was, his party was reelected to power in Jerusalem, and of course, he, Netanyahu, retained the premiership, the prime ministership. Basically, the same thing happened a year ago this month, in November of 2012. A replay of the same thing, another massacre killing, I don't know, 1,000 or 2,000 people. A lot of children. And again, this attack a year ago, this month, was also followed very, very quickly by elections, which again renewed Mr. Netanyahu's position of power in the Israeli government. Let's kill some Palestinians so we can stay in political power. So we have... Aha, what I was getting at was that while Israel is controlling, suppressing, and making the lives of the Palestinians very miserable in the Gaza Strip and in the continually militarily occupied West Bank, the ancestral home of the Palestinian Arabs, no one can dispute that. That, in combination with the continued political disparities inside Israel itself, or behind the green line, if you will, the accepted state of the state of Israel, the Jewish state of Israel, with the suppression of the non-Jewish population there, the denial of their economic rights, and in some cases their civil and even religious rights. I've gone into some depth in previous shows. I'm not going to enter into the details now, not before I read what I'm going to read to you in a few minutes. Finally, those suppressions and the creation of the so-called security fence, more infamously aptly known as the apartheid wall, which in and of itself is a breach of international law. The fact that Israel has taken this horrible concrete restrainment and separated not only Israel from the territories, but Israel's illegal Jewish settlements that are in the territories from the rest of occupied Palestine, from the rest of the West Bank. Slicing and dicing its way across even the property lines of Arabs, separating Arab village from Arab village, neighbor from neighbor, even in many cases cutting directly across the property of these Palestinian Arabs who just want to live their lives with as little hassle as possible. I think everyone in the world pretty much wants that. Often separating houses from their fields or their olive groves. And, of course, those olive groves have been falling by the thousands, if not the tens of thousands, to make way for more Jewish settlements. This is not talked about in the mainstream United States media, period. Once in a great while, a respectable news organization like, say, CBS via 60 Minutes will brave the storm, try to raise their nose above the waves, and report about some of these atrocities which are happening against the mostly unarmed, peace-loving Palestinian Arabs. On two occasions over the last couple of years, 60 Minutes tried to do this, and they paid dearly. AIPAC, the American-Israeli so-called Public Affairs Committee, which is really a political action committee, AIPAC ran rampant. The ADL jumped in there, the American Jewish Committee, people who supposedly speak for the interest of the American Jewish people, and to a large degree they do not, by any means. They attacked CBS News, accused them of a hatchet job this and anti-Semitism and that, merely because they tried for once to get across to the American people who listen to television, watch TV, and listen to the radio, trying to enlighten them and give something of a balanced view, approaching a balanced view of what's going on in Palestine and Israel. And they were made to pay for it. I remember the first of these two shows. The poop hit the fan. And lo and behold, for some other totally inexplicable reason, the very next week, the very following Sunday, 60 Minutes was preempted. So they could show something about President Obama's family. A rerun of human interest fluff, preempting an entire episode of 60 Minutes. Why? It's pretty obvious to me. They were intimidated to exempting an entire episode. You catch my drift. You know what I'm talking about. Okay, it's 11:33 a.m. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're streaming live at the free streaming service on freakradio.org. Click on the big red oval. My name is Ren, and this is the Mideast Madness Show for Saturday, November 23rd, 11:33 a.m. That phone number again is 831-427-3772, 831-427-3772. And let's bring up this sucker here, see what's going on out there. I'm just doing this thing here to electronically keep tabs on how many people are listening to the show. Well, that's a little inspiring. You know, free radio is supported by the community that it serves. We are in non-compliance, total non-compliance with the Federal Communications Commission. This is, in effect, in actuality, a standing and ongoing expression of civil disobedience against corporate radio and its governmental controllers. We are supported roughly 50% by the money that comes in from each and every programmer who has a program on free radio. We pay monthly dues. To support Free Radio Santa Cruz, and the rest of the money has to come from you. Our own bylaws forbid us from taking corporate donations or corporations from certain categories of other fat cats and sugar daddies and all that. Now, if you want to see this radio service continue, particularly if you don't want to let Mideast Madness be sent into oblivion. Please send your donations, checks and money orders to Free Radio Santa Cruz. Just write on the envelope, FRSC, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, zip code 95061. I'll say it again, FRSC, as in Free Radio Santa Cruz, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, two words, Santa isn't ho-ho-ho, Cruz as in capital C-R-U-Z, Santa Cruz, ca, 95061. And just in case you're wondering, probably everyone who is listening to the show live right now, online, is already aware of this. Since 1995, Free Radio Santa Cruz has also broadcast, I'm sure we began broadcasting long before I became a part of it, over the traditional airwaves using a traditional physical transmitter. We have been without the use of a transmitter since the beginning of July of this year. Almost 5 full months. We have a transmitter. She works fine and dandy. The problem is, we do not have a hunk of land to erect the transmitter upon at a usable location where we can feed it with electrical power and service it 24 hours and all that stuff. Alas, we are still working on the problem. I feel such embarrassment right now in saying this because I have promised people soon we'll be back on the traditional airwaves. Soon we'll be back. Soon we'll be back. Free Radio wants to be back for you, not only online, but in the traditional way that you turn on your radio, your non-digital radio, old-fashioned alarm clock and the radio you have in your car. We're working on the problem. If you think you can help us in finding a usable location, it has to be a high elevation, preferably either in the north Santa Cruz de la Viega area or in the western hills of Santa Cruz Poganip. Go to the website that you're listening through right now. Look for the contact information or call me here at 831-427-3772. And I'll try to help direct you to the next most appropriate number or address, etc. Okay, so here we have, as I was saying, in Israel, which through subterfuge, intimidation, force of arms, and endless breaching of international law, United Nations, Geneva Convention, and all that stuff, has made itself comfortable and prosperous at the expense of the native Arabs, and I mean native Arabs. They are indigenous to Palestine. Just as the white European settlers took the land from the so-called red Native American Indians, made life miserable for them, and set them one tribe against another in the process, divide and conquer again, so have many Jews from around the world who constitute and came to constitute the population of Zionist Israel. Upset the balance of life and civility there and made themselves relatively comfortable. My friends, including the author of this book that I'm about to read portions from to you, have come to recognize that this is the case, that Israel, at the expense of the Arabs, have created a situation, a kind of one-way peace or one-sided peace, where they get the bigger piece of everything that they need, strengthen Israel economically, militarily, in terms of the social structure, etc. And on the other side of the Green Line, and as I said earlier, even in many cases within Israel itself, it's a miserable life for the Palestinians, who, and it's not even peaceful for them. They are occupied militarily. One of the most horrible developments over the last couple of years in this whole argument is American Jews are jumping on one of many, many bandwagons of expression in the American Jewish community, and they're yelling, they're repeating this mantra which has come about. There is this peculiar series of mantras that someone in the Zionist community comes up with, and then certain Jewish people who think that they're supporting Israel or think that they're supposed to support Israel will cling to. And one of these is that, oh, no, there's no occupation. There's no such thing as a military occupation of Judea and Samaria or the Gazans. After all, we pulled out of the Gaza Strip. We're only continuing to strangle the life out of Gaza and blaming it on Hamas. There's no occupation, say the Jews. This is disputed territory. It's not occupied territory. It's both, folks. There's no question that the ownership and the rightful possession of the West Bank and Gaza is in dispute. The only problem is people who jump on this mantra are denying that there is also an occupation because it makes them feel better, because it makes them feel innocent. So we have this peace process, as in P-I-E-C-E, which is the only continual peace process going on over there, where the lives of the Palestinian people are in pieces, and the Israelis, in relative comparative terms, of course, are living the life of Riley. I've got a hardback book in my hand that I purchased at a talk given by Mr. Max Blumenthal, American Jew. He signed it for me. I'm hugging it to my chest. Max simply wrote, "For Ren with gratitude." Max Blumenthal, October 29. He was in San Jose on the 29th of last month at the San Jose Peace Center on his book tour and touring regimen. Max Blumenthal, B-L-U-M-E-N-T-H-A-L. The book is entitled Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Max, by the way, is the New York Times best-selling author of Republican Gomorrah. I'll just begin to read some of the soft cover notes when you open up the hardcover of the book. In Goliath, New York Times best-selling author Max Blumenthal takes us on a journey through the badlands and high roads of Israel-Palestine, painting a startling portrait of Israeli society under the siege of increasingly authoritarian politics as the occupation of the Palestinians deepens. Beginning with the national elections carried out during Israel's war on Gaza massacre, I threw that word massacre in 2008 to 2009, which brought into power the country's most right-wing government to date. Blumenthal tells the story of Israel in the wake of the collapse of the Oslo peace process. As Blumenthal reveals, Israel has become a country where right-wing leaders like Avigdor Lieberman and Bibi Netanyahu are sacrificing democracy on the altar of their power politics, where the loyal opposition largely and passively stands aside and watches the organized assault on civil liberties, where state-funded Orthodox rabbis publish books that provide instructions on how and when to kill Gentiles. You're hearing me right, folks. That's what it says here. Introduction to the book. Where half of Jewish youth declare their refusal to sit in a classroom with an Arab, and where mob violence targets Palestinians and African asylum seekers, scapegoated by leading government officials as, quote-unquote, demographic threats. Immersing himself, like a few other journalists, inside the world of hardline political leaders and movements, Blumenthal interviews the demagogues and divas in their homes in the Knesset and in the watering holes where their young acolytes hang out, and speaks with those political leaders behind the organized assault on civil liberties. As his journey deepens, he painstakingly reports on the occupied Palestinians' challenging schemes of demographic separation through unarmed protest. That's through unarmed protests. He talks at length, Blumenthal talks at length, to the leaders and youth of Palestinian society inside Israel. Inside Israel, the state of Israel he's talking about here, now targeted by security service dragnets and legislation suppressing their speech, and provides in-depth reporting on the small band of Jewish Israeli dissidents who have shaken off a conformist mindset that permeates the media, schools, and the military. Through his far-ranging travels, Blumenthal illuminates the present by uncovering the ghosts of the past, the histories of Palestinian neighborhoods and villages now gone and forgotten, how that history has set the stage for the current crisis of Israeli society, and how the Holocaust has been turned into justification for occupation. A brave and unflinching account of the real facts on the ground, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, is an unprecedented and compelling work of journalism. Max Blumenthal is an award-winning journalist and best-selling author whose articles and video documentaries have appeared in the New York Times. And at least one of those, by the way, has been canned by the New York Times. The NYT has refused to show the video on their website. Continuing. Whose articles and video documentaries have appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Daily Beast, The Nation, The Guardian, The Independent Film Channel, The Huffington Post, Salon, Al Jazeera English, and many other publications. His book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, was a New York Times and Los Angeles Times bestseller. He blogs at www.maxblumenthal.com. That's M-A-X. Blumenthal, B-L-U-M-E-N-T-H-A-L, maxblumenthal.com. Introductory remarks. Fairly thick book. I can't begin. I mean, I certainly cannot promise you that we're going to go through the whole thing in one episode. I do not intend, by any means, to read the entire thing to you. It is published just this year, 2013. I'll also note his publication is in memory of Okiva Orr, 1931 to 2013. A couple of quotations prefacing the table of contents. The people don't like to be conquered, sir. And so they will not be. Free men cannot start a war, but once it is started, they can fight on in defeat. Herd men, followers of a leader, cannot do that. And so it is always the herd men who win battles and the free men who win wars. You will find that is so. That was written by John Steinbeck from Mayor Orden. From The Moon Is Down. Another quotation from Israeli Supreme Court Justice Eliakim Rubinstein. Israel is a normal country that is not normal. These two quotes Mr. Blumenthal chose to preface his book. Part one, the campaigns. Part two, laws of the land. Part three, pirates of the Mediterranean. Outcasts, What Lies Beneath the Forest, The Year of Democracy, Feeling the Hate, Part 8, Indoctrination Mills, Part 9, This Belongs to the White Man, Part 10, The Big Quiet, and of course the mandatory maps of the current State of Israel and the Palestinian Territory, the West Bank, including the settlements and barriers, and how the Israelis have made mincemeat out of it, the Gaza Strip. I'm going to go ahead and read the preface to you. The preface of this book. And don't worry about interrupting me. You can call me in at any time, area code 831-427-3772 here in Santa Cruz County on the west coast of North America. And we're still recording here quite successfully. The phones are working. Go back here. Straighten that out. Okay. We're talking about it. Yeah, preface covering Goliath, this literary work called Goliath. In pursuing this reporting project, I have relied on the same journalistic methods that I employed in writing my last book, Republican Gomorrah Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. Obviously, he's talking about the American Republican Party, Republican political party. Just as before, when I journeyed into the American far right and documented its takeover of the Republican Party, I immersed myself in the atmosphere of my subject and cultivated intimate access to those who defined its unique sensibility. This time, my subject is the State of Israel during a period of deepening political and societal crisis. Most Americans know far less about this situation than they do about the political polarization in their own country, but it is an issue on which they have opinions, and an issue of paramount significance to U.S. national security and relevance to their own professed values of democracy, equality, and decency. And it is Americans' tax dollars and political support that are crucial in sustaining the present state of affairs. And he refers, of course, to Israel-Palestine, or Israel. Continuing with the preface, I want to show you what they are paying for, the facts as they really are today, in unadorned and unsanitized form, without sentimentality or nostalgia. Just trying to position this book so I get the maximum light that I need to read it with. Continuing, I began working on this book in May 2009. Almost as soon as I completed the book tour of Republican Gomorrah, and I have conducted uninterrupted research for 4 years through early 2013, when I began When I began, Israelis had just elected the most right-wing government in their history in an election conducted during Operation Cast Lead, a three-week-long military assault on the Gaza Strip that left much of the besieged coastal enclave in ruins, a transitional period that began with the collapse of the Camp David negotiations in 2000 was accelerating. With extreme nationalist elements consolidating control over the key institutions of Israeli society, from the Knesset. The Knesset is Israel's parliament, of course, located in the city of Jerusalem. From the Knesset to the courts, to the educational system and the army. Through my reporting, I attempted to illuminate the impact of this momentous transition on the people themselves, both Jews and Palestinians, charting its progression Through the 2012 Israeli national elections and against the historical backdrop of the cataclysmic events of 1948 that haunt the Holy Land to this day. Thanks to my United States passport and Jewish heritage, I have been able to report from the frontiers of Israel-Palestine with relative ease, receiving favorable treatment from ethnic profiling experts at Ben-Gurion International Airport. Passing effortlessly through checkpoints and cruising from the West Bank to Tel Aviv on highways made off-limits to most Palestinians, I spent months living in Ajami, a rapidly gentrifying Palestinian ghetto just south of Tel Aviv, in central Jerusalem, an increasingly frenetic hotbed of Jewish religious nationalism, and in Ramallah, the occupied, seemingly prosperous capital of a Palestinian state that may never be. I have interviewed leaders of Israeli political parties and leaders of Palestinian protests, and I've done my best to explore everywhere in between and speak with as many people as I could. The stories that make up this book unfolded all around me in the cities and towns throughout Israel-Palestine, in the streets outside my rented flats and inside their walls, through the lives of the roommates, friends, and journalistic colleagues. Of my roommates, friends, and journalistic colleagues. These are the stories of people living under a regime of separation, grappling with the consequences of ethnic division in a land with no defined borders. Readers may not agree with all of my conclusions, but I hope they will carefully consider the facts that appear on these pages. They are, after all, the facts on the ground. Max Blumenthal. That was a very short preface, I think, compared to most books. So I thought I'd get that out of the way. He ends with the expression, facts on the ground. A very oft-repeated phrase. Those four words have been used, perhaps abused, by both sides in this conflict, Palestinian and Israeli. But they are referred to usually in good conscience to try to get people to pay attention to what is really actually going on out there, and not just what some piece of propaganda or what someone's religious scripture says about things. Part one, the campaigns. To the slaughter. That's right, I said, to the slaughter. By the end of 2008, the 1.5 million residents of the Gaza Strip have been left to fend for themselves. Gaza was surrounded on all sides by Israeli sniper towers, electrified fences, concrete walls, and a naval blockade that prevented fishermen from trawling waters more than 3 kilometers from shore. Weaponized drones hovered overhead night and day, humming an incessant single-note dirge that serves as a constant reminder of Israeli control, heeding Israeli government pledges to push Gaza's economy, and I quote here, to the brink of collapse. I'll read that sentence, the beginning of that sentence again. Heeding Israeli government pledges to push Gaza's economy, quote, to the brink of collapse, end quote, army bureaucrats in Tel Aviv develop complex mathematical formulas to regulate the caloric intake of each person trapped inside the coastal strip. Gazans were forbidden from exporting products and prevented from importing cardamom, potato chips, seeds and nuts, cement, fruit preserves, ginger, fishing nets, notebooks, musical instruments, size A4 paper, and toys. It's like an appointment with a dietitian, Dov Wiseglass, an Israeli government aide, joked during a meeting of top military and intelligence officials. He says, the Palestinians will get a lot thinner, but won't die. Again, my friends, I am reading from the last major literary work, the last book from Mr. Max Blumenthal, who is an American Jew, entitled Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, out just this year. Continuing with chapter one of part one, To the Slaughter. With the blockade tightening, a student at the Islamic University of Gaza named Yusuf Al-Jamal watched helplessly as his younger sister was denied a permit to leave Gaza for a basic surgery on her gallbladder. Denied entry on the grounds that she was a quote-unquote security threat, she died days later. I think I better take off this. Excuse me, I'm taking off the soft cover here, the paper cover of this book, because it's just getting in my way, and I'm afraid it's making noises. I do want you to hear this. Okay, continuing with the book. During the time of the siege, Yosef Al-Jamal wrote in his diary, Gaza was turned into an open-air prison. Walls were built to prevent the shine of the sun. Tanks were on the borders prepared to shell, and soldiers observed the hungry and sick people inside, but still prevented them from getting their food and medicine, much in the same way they prevented them from getting their freedom. End quote. For a few hundred Gazan police cadets, December 27, 2008, held the promise of a short relief from the suffocating climate of the siege. That morning in Gaza City, the cadets assembled to celebrate the graduation from Hamas's new police academies, plural. They stood as a symbol of the order that finally presided over Gaza after years of gangland-style corruption and repression by the Fatah-controlled Palestinian Authority, or PA. After winning what the United States Congressional Research Service called a, quote, free and fair election, then fending off a U.S.-backed Fatah coup attempt, Hamas, the Islamist political party, sought to consolidate its control over Gaza, faithfully observing a ceasefire with Israel. In November, Hamas' armed wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, Al-Quds Brigades from the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, fired dozens of rockets at Israeli military bases and towns in the western Negev Desert in retaliation for an Israeli army operation that killed six Hamas members in Gaza. The Israeli raid occurred on November 5, violating the ceasefire one day before the United States election, November 5, when this occurred, when the Western media was almost entirely focused on the outcome of the presidential election. This is in 2008 now. The Hamas rocket attacks caused consternation but did not kill any Israelis. A brass band assembled on the police cadets as the police cadets prepared to march before their commander, Major General Tawfiq Jaber. Many of the cadets' parents hurriedly made their way to the ceremony from across Gaza. Just as the band struck up a martial tune, an Israeli F-16 fighter jet roared across the sky, launching a laser-guided missile into the center of the ceremonial procession. When the choking plumes of thick smoke cleared, a scene of terrible carnage came into view. At least 40 police officers, including General Jaber, lay dead on the concrete. Survivors squirmed around helplessly, writhing in pain, their uniforms stained with the flesh and blood of their comrades. 60 more Israeli F-16s were now in the air on their way to target police stations and civilian installations across the Gaza Strip. Within a matter of minutes, Israeli forces killed 240 Palestinians, including scores of children, while they were leaving school. The initial volley of precision-guided weapons was aimed at civilian targets, from universities to factories to family homes. I shall repeat that sentence. About the Israeli fighter jets, the initial volley of precision-guided weapons was aimed at civilian targets, from universities to factories to family homes. Earlier in the year, Israeli Minister of Defense Matan Vilnai warned the people of Gaza that they, and I quote, will bring upon themselves a bigger Holocaust because we will use all our might to defend ourselves, end quote. I'll interrupt the reading of the book at this point because I want to point out another terrible mantra. I don't know how far this one has gone, but out of the Israeli propaganda bin came the word after this horrible massacre in 2008 that, according to the mantra, supposedly the military, the Israeli IDF, was earning laudits around the world for its the efforts that it made to minimize collateral carnage. I'm not reading from anything in particular here. I'm going by memory. But I did read this somewhere. To minimize carnage of innocent civilians, supposedly, and that the military, and that this was indicative of the nobleness of the world's most moral military armed forces, as the Israelis like to think of themselves, the IDF touts that it is, that they made supposedly these tremendous efforts only to kill the bad guys and not the good bad guys. Okay, continuing now with the book. Let me grab another drink here. I don't want to lose my voice on you now. And it is, by the way, 12:07. 12:07 in the afternoon, this Saturday, November 23rd. This is the Mideast Madness Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're streaming live and free at freakradio.org. Click on the big red oval. Okay, continuing with the reading. In Bethlehem, just over the Israeli separation wall in the occupied West Bank, a 27-year-old Texas transplant named George Hale lit his customary morning cigarette and hustled through the brisk mountain air to his job at Ma'an News Agency, a Palestinian wire service. 2 days earlier, the city center had been lit up with Christmas decorations. Thousands of local Christian worshipers, thousands of them, and international pilgrims had descended upon the Church of the Nativity, fully restored from the destruction wrecked by Israeli troops that had besieged it during the Second Intifada. Now the streets were nearly empty. Hale wandered into the modest office, hung over from drinking late with a few of his expatriate co-workers. He sank into his chair, expecting to spend another day curating reports about ordinary Israeli violence and intra-Palestinian spats. Suddenly, his email inbox began to fill with panicked messages from Ma'an's Gaza Bureau. The first email read, "Israel attacking, hundreds dead." Hale blurted out in disbelief, "Hundreds? Bullshit." With Hale's outburst, the office flew into chaos. Editors grabbed their phones and dialed up Ma'an's Gaza contacts, seeking details about the horror taking place. It was worse than they had heard. Israel was pounding the Gaza Strip with the full capacity of its Navy and Air Force. A land invasion was likely on the way. "Hardly anyone outside Palestine reads our website," Hale said. Hale went on, "Then on the first day, our traffic lit up like we'd never seen before. It almost crashed our server. All of a sudden, the whole world was watching, which basically meant all eyes were on Gaza. As reports of atrocities in Gaza spread throughout the Fatah-controlled Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, Palestinians rushed to organize protests, demanding an end to the rivalry between Fatah and Hamas. Mahmoud Abbas had taken to the local media to howl about the, quote, massacre and act of criminal aggression, end quote, by the Israelis. But the conduct of his security forces, which had been trained by the U.S. General Keith Dayton and coordinated with the Israeli army, belied his militant histrionics. As crowds of Palestinians gathered in downtown Nablus, Hebron, and in Ramallah's Menara Square, the epicenter of Mahmoud Abbas's mini-fiefdom, Palestinian Authority forces swarmed the protesters, arresting them in droves, attacking some with pepper spray, and even killing one demonstrator. Elsewhere in the West Bank, Israeli troops dispersed stone-throwing youths with rubber bullets and tear gas. Calls for the Palestine Liberation Organization, the umbrella group known as the PLO, to break diplomatic ties with Israel were virtually absent from the Palestinian news agency WAFA, the official media organ of the PA, which instead projected an image of widespread protest to Arabic language audiences. In fact, Israel's defense ministry had given Abbas advance notice of the assault on Gaza, beseeching him to take control of the coastal strip after it vanquished Hamas. Though Abbas refused, he kept the governors of Gaza in the dark about the coming onslaught. With the West Bank quieted by a blanket of internal repression, and the Gaza Strip transformed into a theater of human despair, Israeli society was witnessing some remarkable developments. Part two, let's see. No, this is still the general part one, the campaigns. Chapter two, the peace camp. The day after Israeli forces slaughtered the Hamas police cadets, Chaim Oron was awakened at 2:30 in the morning by the sound of knocking at his door. The chairman of the Meretz party threw open the door, allowing a gust of cold Negev desert air to sweep into his home in Kibbutz Lahav. A stranger standing in the doorway handed him a secure mobile telephone. On the line was Oron's good friend, Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. This would be former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. I heard him speak, by the way, in Minneapolis once. Awful person. Awful jerk. Continuing, Olmert relayed a brief but consequential message. The Israeli military had initiated a major attack on the Gaza Strip. After the Prime Minister described the first day of operations, he said goodnight. As the chairman of Meretz, the party founded in 1992 to push for a two-state solution and liberal social policies, Aron was one of the Israeli peace camp's most visible figures. Again, his name was Chaim Oron. The day that the assault on Gaza began, he issued a public statement announcing his full support for the attack, just as he had done at the onset of Israel's assault on southern Lebanon in 2006. The Meretz press release read, "The time has come to act without compromises and without political compromises to defend the residents of the Gaza perimeter and the southern city of Sderot," end quote. And of course, by the Gaza perimeter, he's referring to the Israeli side of the border with the Gaza Strip. Continuing, having endorsed Israel's brutal and bungled bombardment of southern Lebanon in 06 before withdrawing his support, Aron knew full well that a military operation could spiral out of control. But even with two sons serving as officers in the Israeli Air Force, Aron lined up once again with the army. I am living with the constant tension of clashing truths, he later explained to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. I am living with the constant tension of clashing truths. Major icons of the Israeli peace camp echoed Aron's support for the escalating bombing campaign. Chief among them was Aron's friend, the liberal Zionist literary lion, Amos Oz. Pardon me, I believe that's pronounced Amos Oz. Amos Oz. Less than 1 week into Operation Cast Lead, however, at the 80th birthday celebration for Meretz Party founder and peace camp icon, Shulamit Aloni, Oz criticized the assault as, quote, disproportionate. Then 2 months later, he reversed himself again, calling the operation, quote unquote, understandable and acceptable. A.B. Yehoshua, the prize-winning Israeli author, invariably described as a peacenik and dovish in the international media, immediately chided Oz, insisting that the operation needed to be done. And David Grossman, the celebrated Israeli author often portrayed in the West as Israel's anguished conscience, called for a ceasefire in the New York Times, but on purely strategic grounds. He said not a word about civilian casualties. Just 2 days after announcing his backing for Operation Cast Lead, and with national elections approaching, Aron changed his mind. Even though we supported initiating the operation after Hamas broke the ceasefire, now we are saying enough, he said, incorrectly blaming Hamas for initiating the hostilities. But by the time Aron changed his mind, it was too late. Disgusted left-wing voters defected from Meretz to Hadash, which is the non-Zionist Jewish Arab Communist Party, Hadash. Other left-of-center voters began organizing a tactical vote for the Kadima Party, a supposedly centrist umbrella faction that brought together defectors from the once hegemonic but now rapidly crumbling Labor Party and right-of-center elements from the Likud Party that had supported Ariel Sharon's Gaza withdrawal in 2005 against the will of Likud's rightist leader, Benjamin Netanyahu. Liberal Zionists hope that by supporting Kadima and its candidate, the telegenic, Western-friendly foreign minister, Zippy Livni, they could head off a victory by the bellicose Netanyahu, who sought to rally his base within the ideological Jewish settlements of the West Bank. Let me break off here, folks. You know, if I were reading a book about American politics, half of those listening would have been put to sleep by now. At least half of them. We're not even talking about American politics. We're talking about the politics of Israel, political parties that practically no one in this country has ever heard of before or heard of only very wispily. A lot of ins and outs in the politics of a so-called democratic system gone mad, in my estimation, by the way I read this. So again, bear with me. Hopefully, Mr. Blumenthal will move on to something a little more, I don't know, telegenic? More listener and reader friendly. Now, continuing with Chapter 2, The Peace Camp. For more than a week, as the Israeli army escalated its operation against the, quote, cancer in Gaza, only small bands of Israeli radical leftists took to the squares of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem to protest the attacks. Meretz and Peace Now, the liberal Zionist group that had organized major demonstrations in favor of the peace process and the evacuation of Israeli settlements, waited a full 2 weeks before sending their members into the streets. On the seventh day of the assault, the Israeli army's Givati Brigade invaded the densely populated Zaytun neighborhood of Gaza City, attempting to transform the homes of local residents into a base of operations and cut the city off from the rest of the strip. That's the Israeli army, their Givati Brigade, invading and doing this, performing this task here. Continuing, at dawn on January 4, Givati troops burst into the home of a man named Ataya al-Samouni, with their faces blackened for night combat, and tossed a percussion grenade into the center of his salon. When Samouni approached the soldiers with his arms up, waving an Israeli driver's license and his ID, declaring that he was the owner and was unarmed, they shot him and left him to bleed to death while they opened fire on 20 members of his family, badly wounding a 4-year-old child. Next, the soldiers corralled about 100 more people, all members of the Samouni family, and mostly women and children, into a nearby storehouse, forbidding them from fleeing to Gaza City. The soldiers even sent back an ambulance the family had summoned for its wounded. After verifying that the Samounis were unarmed civilians, a soldier barked at them, "You are bad Arabs," in whichever language he used. The following day, when a few older Samouni men attempted to gather firewood and water for those trapped in the house, the army attacked them with heavy ammunition. As soon as survivors of the barrage rushed back to the storehouse for safety, Givati Brigade Commander Ilan Malka ordered airstrikes. Inside the house, the trapped family listened with horror as an American-made Apache helicopter hovered overhead, then launched a fusillade of missiles into the house, reducing it to rubble. 19 members of the Samouni clan died immediately, and several others lay bleeding heavily. 4 days, the Israeli army prevented ambulances from reaching the dead and wounded. When a group of the Samouni family men attempted to evacuate hurt family members who were on the verge of death, Israeli soldiers fired on them. "Go back onto death," a soldier shouted at them in classical Arabic. "Fine," Salah Samouni responded defiantly, determined to carry as many as possible to safety. "Then we will die on this road." After 4 days of agony, rescue crews finally reached the Samouni family, discovering 2 children buried beneath the rubble and dead bodies, but miraculously still breathing. I'll read that again. After 4 days of agony, rescue crews finally reached the Samouni family, discovering 2 children buried beneath the rubble and buried beneath dead bodies, but miraculously still breathing. "My father, mother, wife, and 6-month-old son were killed. I had been married for 1.5 years. My entire life was destroyed," Helmi Samouni told the journalist Jared Malson, who visited the family in the aftermath of the massacre. "After everything that happened," Salah Samouni told Malson, "we still want to know why. We are civilians. There was no resistance in this area. Give a reason." When Palestinian rescue crews finally cleared the rubble of the Samouni homes, they found a total of 48 corpses. Family members returning to the few houses left standing discovered another unpleasant reminder of Israel's incursion. The Givati soldiers had scrawled racist graffiti all over the walls. Racist graffiti. Some of the messages left for the Samounis read, Arabs need to die. Arabs are pieces of shit. And one is down, 999,999 to go. After defacing the homes of Gaza, the young men of the Gavati Brigade returned to their homes only minutes away, inside Israel, and in the settlements of the West Bank. They were not only soldiers, but citizens of the, quote, Jewish and democratic state. As voters, their mood would define the tone of the national elections underway in Israel. Folks, I'm marking that page. I'm going to let the material that I transmitted to you settle and give us a break from the horrible, if highly detailed, description of events from 5 years ago. Let that settle and percolate in your minds and your being. I'm going to look for some light music here to give us a break.
Yeah. كيف حالا وكيف حالا
You've been wondering, this music is from the album entitled Crossing Borders with Sakir Hattar in concert. This was a concert which occurred. I can't find a year or date, but I've had this album for, oh, I'd say a minimum of 7 or 8 years. Back in the Twin Cities of Minnesota, where I lived for a very long time. Sakir Hattar in concert. I do not know his specific nationality. Produced by Sinbad Center Incorporated. Well, the restaurant went out of business some time ago. I don't know what the current status of Sinbad Center is. Or Sinbad Records, whatever. My goodness, time really does fly. We've got about 20 minutes left. It's 35 minutes past 12 noon here on the west coast of California. You're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're streaming live and free at no cost to you at freakradio.org. That's freak as in freak, radio.org. Tell all your friends to click on that big bright red oval for the link to the free streaming service. I'm Ren Tawil, and I'm reading from Max Blumenthal's book that just came out this year, entitled Goliath. Yes, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. Max Blumenthal is the name, strongly infers, is an American Jew. Very enlightened, extremely articulate and learned American Jew who spent time in Israel and Palestine. Having just started the book, and certainly not expecting to read all of it in the course of one or several shows, I just want to give you a taste for Mr. Blumenthal's works and where he's coming from. Still reading from part one, The Campaigns. Chapter one was To the Slaughter. Chapter two, The Peace Camp. Now, chapter three, Blood for Votes. Yes. And we're still recording. Blood for Votes. With Israeli society's nationalistic impulses summoned to the fore in December 2008 and January 2009, leading politicians struggled to outdo one another in a competition for the most convincing exaltation of violence against the Arab evildoers. Subtle suggestions by Zippy Livni's opponents that her gender made her unfit to lead a macho, militaristic country nestled in the heart of a, quote, tough neighborhood, prompted Kadima, the political party Kadima, to produce an ad featuring a blurry-faced male candidate with many impressive achievements who surprisingly morphed into Livni at the end. Who could believe a woman could accomplish such wonders? During press conferences, Livni overcompensated for her gender liability. Hamas now understands if you fire on Israel's citizens, it responds by going wild. And this is a good thing, she proclaimed. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Netanyahu stumped through the fever swamps of Judea and Samaria, the biblically inspired Israeli term for the occupied West Bank, warning radical settlers of the catastrophic consequences of a Livni victory, giving the Palestinians a state of their own, as Livni claims she would do, quote, will simply implant a new Hamas terror base here stacked by Iran with Iranian missiles that would fire on Tel Aviv, Netanyahu told a crowd of settlers. His campaign ads amounted to a collection of his most apocalyptic warnings about the looming specter of Arab terror, presenting him as a prophet of doom, whom his rivals copied, but only after it was too late. Netanyahu's knack for leveraging the fear and trauma of the Jewish public into votes earned him a new nickname among the Israeli press corps, Scaremonger-in-Chief. I think it's vital to understand this aspect of the narrative, so I'm going to repeat that sentence. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu's knack for leveraging the fear and trauma of the Jewish public into votes earned him a new nickname among the Israeli press corps, Scaremonger-in-Chief. Ehud Barak, the defense minister, leader of the dying left-of-center Labor Party, and the most decorated military veteran in Israel's history, boasted on a special election broadcast intended for Russian citizens of Israel, "As you people say, Arab terrorists should be whacked when they're on the toilet." With the crude populist appeal, Barak deliberately channeled Russian strongman Vladimir Putin's famous boast that he would shoot Muslim terrorists even when they were going to the bathroom. Lily Galili, a veteran Israeli journalist who had covered Israel's Russian sector for more than a decade, sorry, folks, distracted myself here. Lily Galili, a veteran Israeli journalist who had covered Israel's Russian sector for more than a decade, reported at the time that Barak, Ehud Barak, was mounting an aggressive campaign to Putinize his image, a makeover that spoke volumes about the state of the Israeli electorate. In his role as defense minister, Barak fueled his political ambitions by attempting to run up the body count in Gaza. As Galili wrote, Barak hopes that the fighting in Gaza will change the tide and restore him as a player in Russian speakers' eyes, end quote. Let me break in here. If I hope that people just listening to that were also, who also may have heard me say earlier on this program, that there was an inseparable link between the 2008 and 2012 Gaza attacks and Israeli politics, in particular the Israeli elections, for those who insist that that is some kind of a bastardization of the truth, and that I am, in my supposed opinions about that, am just trying to muddy up the image of Israeli democracy. Well, now you can hear it from Mr. Blumenthal's words. Returning to Chapter 3, Blood for Votes. Damn it, that's the name of the chapter, Blood for Votes. Barak's makeover was a conscious attempt to outflank the man who stood to gain the most from the belligerent atmosphere that had overtaken Israeli society. He was Avigdor Lieberman, a gruff former bouncer and airport baggage handler from Moldova who fought the far-right Yisrael Beitenu Party in 1999 as a vehicle for Israel's secular Russian population. Each election cycle, Lieberman's party escalated its campaign against Israel's Arab citizens. And each election cycle, it gained at least two new Knesset seats, parliament seats. Earlier in the year, Lieberman previewed some talking points for his upcoming bid for prime minister. At a press conference announcing his departure from the Kadima-led governing coalition in protest of Prime Minister Ehud Olmert's, then Prime Minister Ehud Olmert's, resumption of negotiations with the Palestinian Authority, Lieberman singled out two Palestinian-Israeli members of the Knesset, Mohammed Barakeh and Ahmed Tibi. "The present negotiations with the Palestinians will not lead anywhere," Lieberman thundered. He went on, "Whoever thinks that the reason for the dispute is land and settlements is deluding himself and others. Our problem is not Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, but the extreme fundamentalist leadership that is in the Knesset. Our problem is Ahmad Tibi and Barakeh. They are more dangerous than Hamas president Khalid Meshal of that time and Hezbollah spiritual leader Hassan Nasrallah. They work from the inside. They operate methodically to destroy the state of Israel as a Jewish state." End quote. That was Avigdor Lieberman screaming there. Continuing, as soon as the election campaign began, Yisrael Bitanu blanketed Israeli airwaves with ads hammering on the theme of Arab treachery, reminding Israeli voters that Lieberman, and only Lieberman, would purge the country of its, quote, fifth column. For you younger listeners, fifth column is a reference to Norwegian Nazis during the Second World War. We're going back to the early 1940s when the German Nazis invaded Norway so that they could stage air attacks on London and the British Isles, partly for that reason. They effectively used Norwegian Nazis who came to be referred to as the Fifth Column in taking over the Norwegian government from within, as well as conquering the country militarily. Continuing. Purge the country of its fifth column. One ad featured mugshots of current and former Arab members of the Knesset flashing on the screen, one after another, after a baritone narrator read out supposedly anti-Israeli statements from each politician. Images of Palestinian Israeli students demonstrating against the attack on Gaza at an Israeli university appeared. We won't forget that when the military operation in Gaza had just begun, there were those among us who supported Hamas, the narrator intoned. The ad closed with Lieberman's two campaign slogans, no loyalty, no citizenship, and Lieberman, I believe him. Zippy Livni, for her part, sought to channel Lieberman's transferist appeal into her own candidacy, declaring in a campaign speech that Arab citizens of Israel should seek their quote-unquote national aspirations in a future Palestinian state. I will quickly read you chapter 4, which is entitled The Hill of Shame, and then we'll embark on closing proceedings for this episode of Mideast Madness here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Chapter 4, The Hill of Shame. Parash Hill is a scenic overlook near Sderot, the Israeli city of Sderot, which is one of the underserviced development towns originally constructed in southern Israel to accommodate some of the hundreds of thousands of Jews who arrived to Israel from Arab nations during the 1950s, often as impoverished victims of government-led campaigns of expulsion. This would be Arab government-led campaigns of expulsion. Parash Hill offers sweeping views of the Gaza Strip and beyond it is the Mediterranean Sea. Here, hundreds of Israelis gathered at the vista to revel in the violence. For them, the hill offered mezzanine seats for the bombing. They cheered or stared with silent satisfaction while the hometown team exacted blood vengeance on the enemy. Of course, I'm happy, a 26-year-old Orthodox Jew told a reporter from the United Kingdom's Sunday Times as he watched Israeli jets bombard the strip. He said, it would be better if innocent civilians weren't hurt, but the ones who cooperate with Hamas, that's their problem. A secular middle-aged woman pointed to Gaza and calmly explained to Ulla Turkelsen, a Danish TV reporter, they should just wipe the whole thing off the map. This is an Israeli civilian talking about Palestinians. They should just wipe the whole thing off the map. With a dramatic wave of her hand, she added, yeah, I'm a little bit fascist. A 27-year-old student surveyed the scene of picnicking Israelis and lamented, people in Israel are addicted to violence. Resentment had been simmering among Israelis since the homemade rockets began falling on southern Israel following the Gaza withdrawal. in 2005. They're talking about the Israeli withdrawal from the Gaza Strip in 2005. The humiliating defeat Israeli forces suffered at the hands of Hezbollah in southern Lebanon in 2006 only added to the sense of frustration and anger. By 2008, Israelis were ready for a redemptive war that would reestablish their national morale. So now we're talking about not just politics and elections, but the morale of the populace. Continuing with Mr. Blumenthal's work. During the first week of the assault on Gaza, support for the bombing among Israeli Jews was nearly unanimous, with 90% of respondents expressing their approval. When ground forces entered Gaza several days later, the percentage dropped to 65%, from 90 to 65%, though not because Israelis were outraged by the suffering of Gaza's besieged population. As Ronan Shoval, a right-wing student activist, explained in an editorial for the mainstream Israeli daily paper, Yedioth Aronoth, Israelis saw soldiers as, quote-unquote, their children. The loss of a single one was occasion for a national outpouring of grief. According to Shoval, Israel expressed its moral imperatives not by concerning itself with the lives of the Palestinians, which were immaterial, but by using as much force as it needed to guard the Jewish children from harm. An Israeli soldier identifying himself as Lieutenant Colonel Amir articulated the mentality on Israeli TV during the attack on Gaza, declaring, "We are very violent. We are not shying away from any method of preventing casualties among our troops." Members of Jewish Israeli society who opposed the assault on Gaza in purely moral terms were few and far between, but they made their presence felt by protesting in front of the Defense Ministry in Tel Aviv, in public square, and in public squares around the city. Rebecca Vilkomerson, a Jewish American social justice activist, was living in Israel at the time with her Israeli husband. Ms. Vilkomerson, by the way, is executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace, headquartered here in California. Rebecca Vilkomerson, continuing with the book. When she joined the Tel Aviv demonstrations, she found that she and the leftist protesters were often outnumbered by nationalist mobs that gathered to jeer and attack them. "We had to travel in large groups to the demonstrations just to be safe," Vilkomerson recalled. "Then when we got there, we were behind police barriers to keep the right-wing mobs away. Normal-looking people, businessmen in suits, would see and all of a sudden literally try to hurl themselves over the barrier to attack. They would spit at us, throw rotten eggs at us. There was this sense of nationalism, like, how dare you criticize our war?" During the three-week-long military offensive, okay, folks, we're just too close to close-out time. There's very short chapters in this book of not great length, but obviously a very complete and well-put-together book. Short chapters. Hopefully, I'll be able to continue more of this next Saturday. Please don't forget to tune in to the much longer standing, but otherwise equal, time slot of Mideast Madness in 2 days, every Monday at 3 p.m., 3 in the afternoon, for a couple of hours or so. Mideast Madness Mondays at 3, and of course the weekend edition of Mideast Madness every Saturday at 11, starting at 11 in the morning. So much stuff to cover, so little time. I'm going to sign off now. No phone calls, but I know some of you are listening. I'm just going to check a little something here. Okay. Okay. Audience, as small as it is fairly well intact. Please don't forget, archives of hopefully this and almost all my other shows are available at radioforall.net. That's R-A-D-I-O, the number 4, A-L-L dot net. Radioforall.net. Podcasts of the show are there. Just go to the website, type in Mideast Madness, and pick up your favorite podcast, marked by title and date. Santa Cruz Indie Bay also has information on their calendar, as well as uploaded podcasts of this show. For Free Radio Santa Cruz, I'm Ren Tawil, signing off this weekend's edition of Mideast Madness. Have a wonderful week. And you Americans out there, yeah, I'm one of you. I'm an American. Have a great Thanksgiving holiday weekend next weekend. Be safe.